a terror suspect's roots in a Norwegian village. Today, Thursday, October 24th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. A BBC reporter traces the path of a Somali man accused of being involved in the Westgate Mall attack in Kenya and finds himself in Larvik, Norway.
It's a sleepy, sleepy place. It's a million miles away in every sense from the ravages of Somalia's 20-year-long civil war.
And later, New York City's N line gets a Spanish accent. It's become the Enye line, thanks to some street artists. Also, British folk legend Linda Thompson on why she and her then-husband, Richard, decided to become Sufis back in the 70s.
We were white, overeducated, you know, and looking for some meaning to life.
Plus, remembering Bollywood legend Mana Day.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, developers of the Save a Life Simulator, an interactive online experience designed to teach the public life-saving responses to sudden cardiac arrest. Each day, thousands die from cardiac arrest. Learn how to respond at heartrescuenow.com. And by ITVS, with Independent Lens, exploring the issues in education today through the eyes of six Latino and Latina students from across the United States. The Graduates, premiering Monday night at 10, 9 Central, only on PBS.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Let's break a misconception. You might think a childhood in a quiet, prosperous Western democracy would be enough to dissuade a young man from signing up to wage jihad. Think again. Kenyan authorities say one of the gunmen who laid siege to the Westgate Mall in Nairobi last month grew up in a small coastal town in Norway. 23-year-old Hassan Abdi Duhalo was reportedly identified in video footage of the attack, ruthlessly gunning down shoppers. Today, officials in Oslo admitted they'd had suspicions about the young Somali immigrant. They said they even tried to talk him out of his plans to join a militant group in Somalia. The BBC's Gabriel Gatehouse visited Duhalo's hometown of Larvik, Norway, and talked with members of the suspected gunman's family. They say he called them from Somalia as late as last summer.
Now, his family are under intense pressure, but they said that after Hassan left Norway in 2009 for his first visit to Somalia and then permanently in 2010, he kept in touch only sporadically, that he would call them at odd times of the day, only infrequently, once every few months ago, and always from different Somali mobile numbers. And they didn't have an awful lot of contact with him until the last call, which was, they remembered, last summer. They were a little unclear about which month. They variously said June, July or August. But they said that he told them he was in trouble, that he'd lost his passport, that he'd given it to a trusted friend who wouldn't give it back, that he said he was in trouble and that he wanted to come home.
Well, the pressure may have gotten even higher on the family today because there's news out of Norway that security officials now say Duhalo was well known to them and they met with him several times in Norway and even tried to convince him not to join al-Shabaab. Let's listen to what the head of Norwegian Police Security Services had to say. Her name is Marie Benedict Bjornland.
We did an extensive preventive work towards him. I can't comment on the details, but I can say that we conducted several meetings with him and had preventive talks with him. The result was that he continued his plan and left Norway. We didn't succeed.
I mean, it sounds, Gabriel Gatehouse, like Norwegian authorities kind of knew something was up. Why didn't they stop him from leaving the country again?
Yes, I suppose that's a good question. I would imagine, and I am speculating here, that in the absence of anything concrete on him, and he was never convicted or charged with anything as far as we know in Norway, in the absence of anything like that, he was a Norwegian citizen and presumably free to travel wherever he liked. That said, on the broader picture of people being radicalized in Norway, especially in the Somali community, people who are in the know say they believe that between 20 and 30 Norwegian citizens, almost all of Somali origin, have gone to Somalia to join al-Shabaab in one capacity or another. And in fact, 2 weeks after the Westgate attack, US Navy SEALs carried out an abortive raid on a hideout in Somalia. And the man they were after, we understand, is a guy who goes by the name of Ikrima, whose real name is Abdikader Mohamed. And he's believed to be one of al-Shabaab's most senior operatives. And we also know that he spent approximately 4 years in Norway seeking asylum between 2004 and 2008.
You know, Gabriel, I have to say, looking at the images of this very sleepy Scandinavian town where Duhallo grew up, it's hard to imagine being further away from Somalia. It's just so incongruous, although perhaps not too different from a young Chechen moving to Cambridge, Massachusetts and going off the rails. Did you get that sense of implausibility? I mean, how did that strike you there in little Larvik?
It was extremely odd because it's a really beautiful, picturesque, quintessentially Nordic, Norwegian kind of a place. It's on the sea. It's got a little harbour. The houses, which run up and down quite steep hills, are mostly made of white clapboard. As you say, it's a sleepy, sleepy place. It's a million miles away in every sense from the ravages of Somalia's 20-year-long civil war, the anarchy, the failed state, if you like. This is Norway, an incredibly together state, an incredibly liberal country, which, quite frankly, works. And it is very odd to imagine what a young Somali boy at an impressionable age of 9 would make of moving there and from that vantage point, watching on the internet, keeping in touch with what was going on back home and what kind of things that must have done to his psyche.
The BBC's Gabriel Gatehouse sharing the story of a Norwegian of Somali origin who is believed to be one of the assailants in the Nairobi mall siege last month. Gabriel, good to speak with you. Thanks.
Always a pleasure.
Meanwhile, here in the U.S., immigration is back on President Obama's front burner. Today, the president again called on Congress to pass an immigration reform bill by the end of the year. That seems unlikely, but immigration reform is a top priority for both Democrats and Republicans, given the growing influence of Latino voters. Latino culture is growing in influence, too. That's one of the points being made by a group of street artists in New York City. They recently started pulling tildes on signs for one of the city's subway lines, the N train. A tilde is the curved line that turns an N into the Spanish letter Ñ. Reporter Bruce Wallace went to see what riders think of that.
The N line begins, or ends, depending on your perspective, down by the water at Coney Island, way south in Brooklyn.
This is Astoria, Ditmars Boulevard.
30 stops and an hour later, it ends, or begins, in the Queens neighborhood of Astoria.
This is the last stop on this train.
The Ñ ferries, who sprinkled tildes on the yellow and black inline signs at various stops, apparently didn't make it out this far. The amended signs are concentrated toward the middle of the line as it runs through Midtown and downtown Manhattan and central Brooklyn. These are busy stations, though, and not many people there seem to have time to stop and notice. Down at the end stop in Sunset Park, Brooklyn, a neighborhood that's nearly half Hispanic, more commuters were willing to stop and ponder. Some were not amused.
Why, they don't know what N is without the...
Oh, no, they totally do. It's kind of a joke.
Yeah. I don't find it funny at all. It's stupid.
The Ñs are the work of Z Street Art, a project that's throwing up new pieces of public art each day for 6 months. The Ñs, which went up Saturday, are their first strike. The group explained on their Tumblr page, quote, "The N line is now the Ñ line for the 24.28% Spanish speakers in New York City." A multicultural advertising agency launched a similar effort last year, urging New York City's MTA to change the N line to the Ñ line annually during Hispanic Heritage Month. Some commuters in Sunset Park were intrigued by the project.
Wow, that's crazy, man. I don't even know what that means, you know?
I explained the artist idea to Deshaun Sumter.
Oh, okay. I got Spanish friends, you know what I'm saying? I give props to them, you know? We all American people, you know? We all got to give props to each other.
A couple writers had ideas about other lines with possible Spanish implications. One guy suggested the L line could be respelled E-L, to make the Spanish article V. Another worried about the possible confusion of the rolled R in the R line. A few Spanish-speaking school kids said they thought it was cool that their language was getting some recognition. Claudia Lechuga.
Lechuga, which actually means lettuce in Spanish, yeah.
She lives right by the Sunset Park Inn stop. She's into the Ñ.
I love it. I think it's pretty great. it's so cute. I mean, it's kind of a nice homage to what the neighborhood has been historically.
The Enyés found a fan in Blanca Gonzalez, too.
It's so cool.
She's originally from Mexico and runs an employment agency nearby where the clientele is largely Hispanic. She likes the message, although she's a bit worried about the delivery.
It's like two sides of the story, because first of all, I think it's not good to be doing graffitis. You know what I'm saying? But on the other side, it's kind of, they want to be here. You know what I'm saying? Like, there has to be a message that they want to send, like saying, yes, hello, we exist in here and we need to be represented somehow. And you can just deny that we are here. So listen to us.
Sunset Park is also home to a big Asian community, including John Lee, who works right around the corner. Like any good New Yorker, he's skeptical.
People don't pay attention. They're too busy in their own world, right? I'll tell you.
He pointed out a young couple hugging near an Enye.
Look at these lovers. They don't care about the end line. Do you care about the end line? Hell no, they don't care about the end line. No one cares.
For The World, I'm Bruce Wallace, writing the Enye line in New York City.
We have more on subway line subversion, not just in New York, in our latest World in Words podcast. That's at PRI.org. Next on the program, we hear from a Syrian immigrant about his first days in America back in 1984. It's part of our ongoing series inspired by Philadelphia's South Asian American Digital Archive.
My name is Kareem Shamsi Basha. I am a photojournalist and a writer. I grew up in Damascus, Syria. In school, I would watch the government officials' kids get A's for not even showing up. I would stand in the bread line for an hour, and the official's driver would just walk straight in, get the bread and walk straight out. Just unfairness, injustice, you know. Those may not be huge deals to some people, but they were to me. My dad was a poet and a writer, and he encouraged me to leave when I was 18. The University of Tennessee accepted me, so I came to Knoxville. It was a very easy decision to make because I knew they had one thing here that we didn't, which is freedom. And I wanted that really, really bad. Knoxville was very aired out, very spacious. Front yards, backyards. We don't have that in Damascus. In Damascus, you smell the meat being cooked. You smell jasmine on the sidewalk. You smell herbs and spices. And here it was less smelly. Here people are more private, so they don't advertise what they have via smell or via anything else, really. So when I first came, the guy I lived with said, "Where are you from?" And I said, "Damascus, Syria." He said, "Oh, like in the road to Damascus." I didn't know what to say, so I just brushed it off and go down to the lobby. The guy at the checkout, he said, "Where are you from?" And I said, "Where'd you come from?" And I said, "Damascus." He said, "Oh, as in the road to Damascus." I'm like, "What is with these people?" And she said, no, that, as in, like from the Bible, the road to Damascus, from the Bible. And I said, "I'm a Muslim. I don't know what you're talking about." So I go look up the road to Damascus in the Bible, and after I understood what they were asking about and I understood it was in the Bible, I'm like, "You're associating me with something that is very dear to your heart. I like that."
Kareem Shamsi Basha recalled his first days in America for reporter Ashley Cleek. We've collected many amazing stories like that one. You can record your own first day's memories right on our website. Just look for the orange record button at PRI.org/First Days. This is The World from PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic Philanthropy, developers of the Save a Life Simulator, an interactive online experience designed to teach the public life-saving responses to sudden cardiac arrest. Each day, thousands die from cardiac arrest. Learn how to respond at heartrescuenow.com. And by ITVS with Independent Lens, exploring the issues in education today through the eyes of six Latino and Latina students from across the United States. The Graduates, premiering Monday night at 10, 9 Central, only on PBS.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Coke, as the ad says, is the pause that refreshes. In the eyes of gay rights activists, though, Coke needs to take a pause themselves and think seriously about the Winter Olympics in Sochi, Russia, now just 3 months away. Andre Banks is executive director of the gay rights organization All Out. He joins us from New York. So the Russian government's got this anti-gay propaganda law, Andre. They've been also cracking down on gay rights marches in several Russian cities. You've organized an online petition to address this, to put pressure on Olympic sponsors, especially Coke. Tell us what this petition asks of the sponsors.
Absolutely. Well, it asks them to speak out. So it specifically asks for Coke to call on the Russian government to remove the anti-gay propaganda laws before the Olympics in Sochi, to support LGBT organizations in Russia who are pushing back against this crackdown, and to encourage the IOC to change the rules to make sure that we don't end up in this position again, that we don't end up with an Olympics in a country that treats gay and lesbian athletes badly.
Right. Is there an ultimatum if you don't get the satisfaction you want from this petition?
Well, I think what we've heard from those, you know, now more than 120,000 people have signed this in just a couple of days. I think a lot of people are looking at Coke and asking the question, will they speak up and will they take a stronger stance? And we continue to take this question to them for the next few months.
I mean, Coke did come out with a statement in August that said, as one of the world's most inclusive brands, we value and celebrate diversity. We do not condone intolerance or discrimination of any kind anywhere in the world. What more do you want from them?
What we want Coke to do is just to live up to their values. You know, if you're a Coke employee in the U.S., the company does have great values for lesbian and gays. What we're saying is that shouldn't stop when you cross the Atlantic and go to Russia and go to Sochi. People in Russia want the same things that people in the U.S. want, and Coke should do everything in their power to make sure that the Olympics stays a place where athletes and sport and fairness is the goal and not discrimination.
Andre, how do you respond to the notion that sports, and the Olympics especially, should not be complicated by politics, but should focus on the athletics?
I absolutely agree, but the IOC makes it, the International Olympic Committee makes it very difficult to focus on the athletics when you put the Olympics in a country that says that you can't say that you're gay without facing fines or possibly being taken to jail. It's hard to keep the politics off of the rink when you're being put in that situation. And I think that's the choice of the International Olympic Committee and the sponsors who have allowed the Olympics to go forward in Sochi.
With 3 months to go before Sochi, why not just put all the chips on the table and call for a boycott of the 2014 Winter Olympics or for moving the game somewhere else?
You know, first of all, we've been working closely with our human rights defenders in Russia, and they say they don't want a boycott. They want the world to come to Russia for these games and to use it as an opportunity to speak out and not to walk out. I think they want to see these powerful voices, governments in sport, athletes, sponsors, to take a strong stance against these anti-gay laws and show the Russian government that, you know, there are many voices who are on the other side who want to see a change. You know, there is a real precedent for this. Before the Olympics in Beijing, the Chinese government changed a number of laws to come into support from this international community and sponsors. In London in 2012, the IOC forced the Saudi Arabian government to include women in their Olympic delegation. So, you know, there is a precedent for these kind of changes, and I think we're hoping to see people really step up and make it happen before February.
Have you heard from Coke at all about your online petition?
We have not heard from them directly about the online petition. We do know that they are in active conversations about this, and I believe they're taking it quite seriously. And we're hoping that, you know, even as soon as this week, that we'll get to hear back from them and hear a strong response.
Well, the Olympics get underway in February. Are you going, Andre? And what do you want your role to be if you do go?
You know, I think my role is to help amplify the voice of human rights defenders in the country and, you know, the hundreds of thousands of people that have joined All Out's campaign. I would love to go to Sochi. We're, you know, it's actually become quite a challenge for people to get visas, especially if you are an outspoken gay rights activist, not surprisingly.
Andre Banks with the Gay Rights Campaigners All Out in New York. Andre, good to speak with you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
We contacted Coca-Cola for a response today, but so far we haven't heard back. You can read Coke's full statement from August at PRI.org. The next Winter Olympics, after Sochi, takes place in South Korea. But the drink in question there right now isn't Coke, it's coffee. Koreans have had a love affair with coffee in recent years, but that seems to be cooling off. We often turn to reporter Jason Strother in Seoul to explain all things Korean for us. So I asked him why coffee sales are down.
Marco, there are a few reasons behind this latest trend here. One, Koreans just don't have that much money anymore. Household debt is super high. There's youth unemployment that's double the national average. People just don't have the money to go out and spend $6 on a latte anymore.
That's what it costs, $6 for a small latte?
That's not unusual, especially in the more trendy, posh cafes of, let's say, Gangnam. Coffee is a really new thing here. 10 years ago, when I first came to Korea, what you got basically was coffee-flavored water. There was a lot of mixed coffees with powdered milk or sugar additives put in. But it was really within the past several years that this coffee culture took place, and it's become a real status symbol. It's sitting in a trendy cafe in Gangnam, sipping your latte, your Americano. It's as much of a status symbol as it is carrying a Louis Vuitton bag for many Koreans. They want to be seen. They want to take the window seat. It's a place to be. It's a place to socialize, especially for young women. But like most trends, things fade after time.
Are you saying that it's just going from trend to kind of reality now? Enough of this expensive trend.
Sure. I think that the Korean coffee franchises here, Cafe Bene, for instance, they've put a lot of money into upping its brand value by signing on with celebrity spokespersons, really advertising themselves as this posh, high class, sort of establishment to hang out and get your coffee. That worked in the years before, but now I think the economic reality has set in.
So what culture does the youth lose when they can't go into these coffee shops anymore because they can't afford it?
Because many young Koreans live with their families, they try to spend as much time out of the house as possible, and cafes provided that type of outlet for them. It's not a place where you have to pound alcohol, which was one of the main ways to get it, one of the main places where you spent time out of the house in the past. It was a place where you could sit down, you could have a coffee, you could check your email, you could read, you could chat with your friends. This type of environment wasn't here before. I don't think it's going anywhere anytime soon, but at least the amount of money the Koreans will be spending inside these cafes will probably decrease.
Seoul-based reporter Jason Strother, thanks so much.
Thank you, Marco.
The World is not just on the radio, by the way. There's our digital home at PRI.org. And another great way to find us is with the Flipboard app. Imagine your radio becomes a magazine with pages you can flip through, read the articles, and you can still hear all the voices you know from the world. It runs on your iPad, iPhone, or Android device. And you can find it at flipboard.com/theworld. You're listening to The World on PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, when an Egyptian-American filmmaker decides to shoot a documentary about protesters in Cairo's Tahrir Square, even her own family and friends have tough questions for her.
What else is there to fight for? Mubarak has stepped down. It's time for the country to move forward. So what are they still doing there?
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, developers of the Save a Life Simulator, an interactive online experience designed to teach the public life-saving responses to sudden cardiac arrest. Each day, thousands die from cardiac arrest. Learn how to respond at heartrescuenow.com. And by ITVS, with Independent Lens, exploring the issues in education today through the eyes of 6 Latino and Latina students from across the United States. The Graduates, premiering Monday night at 10, 9 Central, only on PBS.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Germany is paraphrasing Ricky Ricardo today. America's got some splaining to do. The German Foreign Ministry summoned the American ambassador today and told him Germany wants an honest and full explanation of U.S. surveillance operations in Europe. And Chancellor Angela Merkel repeated her concerns that her own mobile phone is being monitored. Today she told a European summit that spying among friends is simply not done. The U.S. denies it, but the Europeans are not convinced. Journalist Ryan Gallagher has been reporting for Slate on the arguments in Europe over the legality of the surveillance. He's also a fellow at the New America Foundation. Tell us what the Europeans are so upset about, first of all, Ryan.
Well, they're very aggrieved that I think it's mainly the scale of some of the surveillance that's been disclosed that some of the governments over in Europe just claim that they had no idea what's going on. I mean, talking about sort of millions of communications, records of people's phone calls being monitored. So there's just a lot of fury about it. I think mainly because the leaders didn't seem to have been briefed on a lot of these things, or so they claim, by the Americans. And so they're very angry about that.
And now that they do know, where do the real legal issues lie?
In Europe, they'll see what's gone on as a violation of various treaties, for instance, the International Convention on Civil and Political Rights, because that enshrines the fundamental right to privacy of communications. It's also a likely violation of the Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations, because the NSA seems to be tapping the phones of politicians and diplomats in Europe. But I can't really see this going through any sort of criminal court or anything like that. That would be too politically contentious.
And how do those legal issues stand up that you just listed? How do they stand up when France and Germany are also spying? I mean, there have been numerous allegations that France spied on its citizens. Der Spiegel reported back in July that Germany worked with the NSA to spy on Germans. I mean, does that matter? Does that count?
Yeah. Well, I think that does matter, and definitely there's an element of hypocrisy here. However, I think the scale of the outrage from some of the politicians, some of the lawmakers in Europe, it's because they're concerned about the US creeping into other countries in a way that they didn't really realize is going on. So while the French might be monitoring their own citizens, the Germans too, I don't think that the Germans will be tapping into American communications on American territory.
Have you heard of Europeans bringing up the perennial issue of American exceptionalism? You know, why America thinks it's okay to surveil other countries, but not other countries surveil the U.S.?
I mean, I think that that does come into it, because the argument that's been put forward quite aggressively by spokespeople for the administration, for the White House, they've said, well, look, you know, this is what we do. We're trying to protect the world, sort of thing. And, I think for a lot of, especially in Germany, where they have this legacy of, they have a very sort of scarred memory to do with surveillance, that they just take offense at any kind of mass intrusive surveillance. And so I think that argument doesn't cut it in Europe with some nations.
Ryan, before I let you go, I have to ask you this curiosity question. Does anybody in Europe really think Angela Merkel does serious business over her mobile phone? I mean, isn't she just like making restaurant reservations or something?
Well, do you know, that's an interesting point, because working in this field for a few years in issues of surveillance, you would be very surprised to learn of the terrible information security that high-level officials in certain governments have. You know, they don't use encrypted telephones. They sometimes use personal email accounts to conduct official business and things like that. So, you know, it wouldn't surprise me if Merkel had used a sort of normal consumer BlackBerry to do some sort of government business. But I don't know that. But it wouldn't surprise me. I certainly think that she'll be changing our behaviours now that these leaks have come out about the alleged tapping of her phone.
Yeah, she better be changing it now. Ryan Gallagher, journalist and future tense fellow at the New America Foundation. Thank you.
No problem. Thanks, then.
That's a tough one for the White House, but perhaps President Obama's biggest high-tech headache at the moment is the sloppy healthcare.gov rollout. Some might blame Canada. That's because one of the subcontractors facing scrutiny for the website's many failings is CGI Federal, a unit of Canada's biggest IT company, the Montreal-based CGI Group. Whatever its role in the Obamacare controversy, we wondered how CGI's model of doing business across borders fits in with Montreal's economy as a whole. Well, it turns out high tech and exports have been key to the city's recent economic recovery. I asked Richard Schirmer, a professor of urban and regional development at McGill University, what Montreal's secret is.
I don't think there's just one secret. There's a variety of things that need to be taken into account. But maybe the first thing is that this is not just a recent success. This is something that has been building up over a number of years and, in fact, stretches back quite a long way into Montreal's industrial history. The more recent phenomenon that's been happening is that at least for the last 20 years or so, there's been a concerted effort by the provincial government and also by the city to promote sort of high-tech manufacturing, such as the aeronautical industry, such as pharmaceuticals, but also to promote knowledge-intensive services.
I mean, we've heard, of course, about CGI exporting its services, but do they represent one of many companies right now in Montreal doing the same thing?
Yes, they do represent one of many companies. There's another very large one, SNC-Lavalin, a multinational engineering services firm. And there are many slightly smaller ones who are spanning the globe, both in engineering consulting and also consulting related to mining and other industrial type activities. So we're not necessarily talking about the management consultants, the financial consultants. Those types of jobs are now have gone to Toronto. That occurred really in the 1970s. But Montreal has picked up on this industrial consultancy, the engineering consultants, and they now have a number of large multinationals which are very active throughout the globe.
I mean, we're really talking a city that for the last decade or more has really been focused on innovation. What about having two languages, English and French? Has that helped or hurt innovation in Montreal?
I think in the short term, many people would say that is an impediment because there's a lot of arguments between the Francophones, Anglophones, which language should dominate. It also makes it somewhat more difficult to attract a global workforce. But I think in the longer term, the presence of these two large European cultures at loggerheads creates a tension which on the whole is fairly constructive. People here can't be complacent. They're always confronted with a different point of view. So because there is this tension, I think this does then translate not only into the industries in the city, but also into the city's culture and social innovation. I mean, there's a lot of music is coming out of Montreal right now. And having heard interviews with the musicians and knowing the scene a little bit, at least through my daughters, it's clear that the fact that there is a double culture in Montreal, we always get people coming over from France, people coming up from the States, from the rest of Canada, means that it's a meeting place for the English and the French views of the world, which I think then does translate into a wider approach to innovation, or at least to new ideas, which is quite particular to Montreal.
Right. But now with Obamacare and CGI there in Montreal taking a lot of the heat for the healthcare.gov foul-ups, will Montreal pay a price for this?
I think obviously Montreal's reputation is going to take a bit of a beating. I mean, first of all, because Montreal was off the radar and now it's on the radar, it's not on the radar for a very good reason. I think there's also a downside, though, to what we've been talking about, which is the fact that we do have all this innovation. We do have these service companies which are exporting. We do have some high-tech manufacturing. But nevertheless, the actual real incomes or GDP per capita in Montreal remains very low. So I think there's a downside to what we're talking about as well. But obviously, in terms of Montreal's image, although CGI is maybe not promoting it in a great way right now, I think the underlying argument that there are a lot of global consulting companies operating from Montreal is true. And this does reflect something fundamental about Montreal.
Well, many cities get a second shot, so I wouldn't be too worried.
Okay.
Richard Schirmer, Professor of Urban and Regional Development at McGill University. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
Egypt's ousted Islamist president is expected to go on trial early next month. Mohamed Morsi's supporters are calling for yet another round of protests, and there are fears of more bloodshed and street violence between demonstrators, counter-demonstrators, and security forces. The situation in Egypt is chaotic, to say the least, and that chaos is the context of a new documentary film by an Egyptian-American filmmaker. The World's Matthew Bell, who spent time reporting in Egypt, had a chance to speak with her this week.
January 25th, 2011, the day the Egyptian revolution began. Jehan Nujaim had her camera that day, but like just about everybody else, she wasn't sure if the rumors about big protests would turn out to be true. So she left Egypt to chase some government officials to a conference in Europe.
I was on the way to the airport. I was thinking to myself, I could be making the biggest mistake of my life by leaving on this day.
Sure enough, something big was happening back in Cairo. As protesters took control of Tahrir Square and called for Hosni Mubarak to step down, Jehan Nujaim made her way back from Switzerland. Her camera was confiscated at the Cairo airport. Then secret police detained her for questioning for a day. Nujaim had a moment of panic, worried that she was missing out on the story of a lifetime.
It may have been a blessing in disguise, actually, because it completely removed the temptation of making the film that most people have made, which was this 18-day film, right, up until the removal of Mubarak. And it really forced us to begin the film with the stepping down of Mubarak.
So the story in her new film, The Square, sort of begins with a climax. Nujaim introduces her main characters, most of them Egyptian activists of one kind or another, spending a lot of time in Tahrir Square. But pretty quickly, the sense of triumph vanishes, and things get messy. The Egyptian army, police, violently cleared Tahrir Square only several weeks after Mubarak stepped down. One of Nujaim's characters gets detained and beaten up badly. Another character goes to visit the young man and document his injuries on video. At the time, when Nujaim posted that footage online, she says people just didn't believe it.
Many friends of mine who are intelligent, well-read friends of mine in Egypt said there's absolutely no way that this could have happened. There's no way that the army would do this. And you realize that there's a story there that has to be told.
Did you ever get real pushback, maybe from your family or friends, like confronting you and saying, Jihan, stop, this is a problem?
There was a lot of that kind of attitude of, oh, you know, there's Jihan making her film again, but, you know, what are you really going after in the square, you know? And you think these, like, YouTuber kind of Twitter people are actually going to make any kind of difference in this country?
At certain times, Nujaim's protagonists wonder the very same thing.
It's shocking that however many people died yesterday, the whole country is in outrage. Is there still a possibility for enough people to be convinced that action en masse can change the future of the country? And if people are stopping to believe that, then as a revolution, we're in trouble.
The Square covers 2.5 tumultuous years, right up through the overthrow of Mohamed Morsi this past summer. And the characters spend much of the film wrestling with some of the tough questions forced on Egyptians by the never-ending upheaval. How do people deal with the cycle of violence? Where's the breaking point? And what happens when revolutionaries turn on each other? Nujaim was arrested several times herself. She's seen plenty of death, pain, and suffering.
It was heartbreaking. It was completely heartbreaking. But then you see these shining lights, and that's what we focused, that's what I like to focus on in the film, because you focus on people and ideas that need to be shared with the world. Otherwise, why are you making a film? So people that say, oh, this shows that Egypt is a failed state. No, this was a founding period of Egypt. And I think what this film shows is that even if it's just a dedicated few sitting in a square, it's the dedicated few that are able to inspire others to continue to make a difference.
The Square opens in New York on Friday and Los Angeles on November 1st. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
And before we take a break, a quick heads up for you on a story we're going to have for you tomorrow. It's about a rug, not just any rug. This one was woven by Armenian orphans sometime in the 1920s and given to President Calvin Coolidge as a gift.
It's a beautiful piece, very colorful. It has on it many images of animals and plants, and there is the sense by people who know what these images suggest that it represents probably the Garden of Eden.
So what happened after President Coolidge got the rug in 1925? Well, you'll have to tune in tomorrow to find out. This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com. And by Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting 12 Years a Slave, the true story of a man who overcame more than a decade of injustice to reclaim his freedom, in theaters now.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Richard and Linda Thompson were the king and queen of the British folk music scene that emerged in the 1970s. Their unofficial royal status crumbled after the couple divorced in the early 80s. A lot of water under the bridge since then. And now Linda Thompson has just released her first new album in 6 years. It's called Won't Be Long Now.
Oh, never.
got the song Never the Bride on this album, and its line, I'm bound to live a single life, never, oh, never the bride. You have been married before, so this isn't an autobiographical ballad. Are you single now?
No, I mean, part of the reason I wrote that song, it's quite ironic, is that I've been married since I was 16, not to the same person, of course, that would be ridiculous. But I sort of envy unmarried people sometimes, you know, I just do. Well, I'm just going to be truthful, I envy them the whole time.
Yeah, and so why be married?
Actually, I'm kidding. I'm glad my husband isn't listening to this. He lives in London. No, it's just that because I've never, has spent long periods alone, I just think it would be nice. But then my unmarried friends say it's awful. So what are you going to do?
Let's go back a little bit. I mean, you and Richard Thompson, your ex-husband, former full-time musical partner, had an album in 1975 called Pour Down Like Silver. Can I ask you, who is that on the album cover? He looks like a mystic of some sort.
Is that the album where it's two faces on each side?
I believe so, yeah. I mean, the face on the front,
well,
it's kind of like little braids in the beard. It looks like a holy man.
Yeah, I think it's Richard, and I'm on the other side. That was when we were Sufis. Yeah, well spotted there. We were definitely trying to be holy something.
Tell me about that chapter in your life with Sufism. I mean, it's this practice within Islam that's mystical and musical and artistically expressive. I'm just curious, in the U.S., it never really penetrated the way it did in Europe in the 70s. So why was it so embraced by the counterculture in Europe?
You know, I don't know, because it seems that it was very culty. It seems that it would have been perfect for American people as well as English people. But it's the usual kind of culty thing. We were white, overeducated, and looking for some meaning to life. So we sort of stumbled upon this. And, we lived in a commune, and I don't recommend communal living. It's bad enough having next door neighbors, never mind having people in the same bloody bathroom as you are. But I suppose we gleaned something from it. We made some music, and then we stopped doing music for quite a long time.
I mean, now Islam has this whole other context today. I'm just curious how you see Islam today and how you react when you hear how the religion is so often singled out in the West.
Well, I understand why it is. I understand why it is because of the atrocities. You know, there's been some atrocities committed in the name of Islam that are unconscionable. But I do believe that most Muslims are law-abiding citizens. You know, there are fanatics. You know, it's just until there's some kind of resolution, and I'm not sure there ever will be. It's going to be hard on Muslims.
Do you ever kind of return to kind of the understanding of Sufism you had a couple of decades ago today?
Well, it's funny because one of the tenets of Islam, as you probably know, is no pork and no alcohol. Well, last night I had a couple of lychee martinis and I had a bacon sandwich for breakfast. So I've gone about as far away from the tenets of Islam and Sufism as you can. But I still like the music.
Singer and former Sufi Linda Thompson. Her new album just released is called Won't Be Long Now.
As fast my little feet can carry me, as fast my little wings can fly, as fast as automobile can ferry me, as fast as that thing can drive. The sound of red and aluminium baking in the setting sun, shining like a silver star. My little feet can carry me, as fast my little wings can fly.
And finally today, we switch our musical focus to pay tribute to a true Bollywood legend.
Pyar hua, iqrar hua hai, pyar se phir kyun darta hai dil.
The voice of Manna Day can be heard on hundreds of classic songs from decades of Bollywood movies. He passed away early this morning in Bangalore, India. He was 94. If his name doesn't ring a bell for you, the world's Manya Gupta is here to help us out. She grew up in Lucknow in northern India. How would you describe Manna Day, Manya?
Manna Day was this classically trained playback singer, and he sang thousands plus songs for a lot of different actors, and probably more than one language for sure, because he was born in Bengali and then he sang for Hindi films.
Now, when you say playback singer, what do you mean?
In Hindi cinema, it's like the actors never really sing. It's people who have really good voice, who are classically trained. They are the ones who sing the song and the actors just mime on screen.
Right. So basically lip syncing.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
Do you remember listening to the music of Mana Day when you were growing up?
He basically was from my parents' generation. So, you know, when I was getting ready for school back like 20 years ago, I remember, you know, the radio was on and my mom probably making breakfast and my dad getting ready and then his songs playing on the radio. So that's what I remember growing up, you know, listening to his songs on the radio.
What about the younger generation in India today? Any kind of like retro appreciation of singers like Mana Day or any of the older Bollywood playback singers?
I think a lot of those songs sung back probably 30, 40 years ago still are very popular in India. And I think that the younger generation still listens to them. Definitely some of the songs are very popular even till date.
Do you have a favorite song from Mana Day?
I think one of his most popular songs is O Meri Zohra Zabi, is basically this guy who's a middle-aged guy. He's appreciating his wife and he's saying that even though I've grown, but my love for you has not changed over the years and stuff like that. It's a beautiful, beautiful song. It's very lively, very peppy. It's really good and it's one of my favorites.
The World's Manya Gupta, thanks so much.
Thanks, Marco.
And we leave you with the sounds of Bollywood and the late great playback singer Mana Day. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. See you tomorrow.
तुझे मालूम नहीं तू अभी तक है हसी और मैं जवान तुझ पे कुर्बान मेरी जान
is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org, by the Annenberg Foundation, and by the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can, and by the PRI Global Reporting Fund, providing in-depth reporting on a diverse array of important topics, including global health. Donors to the fund include Marguerite Steed Hoffman and Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.